So Vayishma Yisro, right? Yisro heard. Jethro, or Yisro's arrival, his reception by Moshe, the advice that Yisro gave, and his departure, it's related here in Parshas Yisro, the very beginning, which immediately precedes the giving of the Torah. The war with Amalek is also recounted immediately prior to Matan Torah. Why are these two incidents a prologue to Matan Torah? Yisro was a Gentile. Essentially, he was the Archbishop of Midian. He came to the Jewish camp with an open mind. He wanted to observe for himself what the Jews had accomplished and were about to engage in. He was so overwhelmed by their conduct that he renounced paganism and he embraced Judaism. Chazal did not describe Yisro as a saintly Gentile. Rather, he is portrayed as a decent person whose positive reaction should have been emulated by other Gentiles who witnessed the exhibition of Matan Torah. This incident illustrates one possible reaction of a Gentile to the Jews and to the experience of Matan Torah. The Amalekites, they were also impressed with the Jews, but their reaction differed from that of Yisro. They believed that a nation which could defy Egypt and the Pharaoh, could gain freedom from the Pharaoh, and defeat the Egyptian regime, while having different laws from those which prevailed all over all the rest of the world, such a nation should be exterminated. Amalek came and attacked the Jews. The Jews had not threatened Amalek in any manner whatsoever, yet Amalek attacked them anyway. This was their reaction to what happened to the Jews. In the biblical account, the presentation of the first set of the Luchos, the first set of the tablets given to Israel at Mount Sinai, was accompanied by tremendous fanfare. In the words of the Shofaros section of the Musaf Rosh Hashanah, it says, "With voices and thunder you revealed yourself to them, and through the sound of a shofar did you appear to them." God wanted the world to know that the Jews had received the Luchos, and that the Luchos, the tablets, contained a new moral code, a new outlook, and a new set of laws. It was not necessary for other nations to accept this code. It was, however, crucial that the nations be aware of it. Why was this awareness among the nations necessary? The purpose of the public spectacle of Matan Torah was so God could eventually convert the entire universe to become the residence of God. All will accept the reign of God. The time will come when the whole world must realize that the Luchos, the tablets given to the Jews, contain the truth. And it is worthwhile to accept them, just as the Jews accepted them so many years ago. The purpose of Matan Torah was not for the individuals, but to convert the entire cosmos, the whole universe, into a divine residence. The Torah was offered to everybody, and must eventually be accepted by everybody. This offer was extended to every human being, yet the Jews were the only nation who took advantage of the offer. The Jews were sensitive, understanding the exaltedness and beauty of a life which is lived in compliance with the laws of the Torah. No other nation understood this concept. Still, God exposed all of humankind to this event to allow them the opportunity to accept it. Will humankind eventually accept this reality and ultimately realize the greatness of a Torah lifestyle? The Torah answers in the affirmative and offers the story of Yisro as proof. In the eschatological era, the same event will occur on a universal scale. The Torah, however, also wants us to know that there are certain people who will never be converted. They understand that the Jew represents something unique, but their response to that realization is one of malice, of vicious hate, and a desire to destroy. Amalek was the incarnation of evil and regarded Matan Torah in a completely different manner. Amalek attacked us without provocation and for no reason, other than that we were a unique and a separate entity. Amalek and their descendants will continue to react this way throughout history. The Gentiles, they will react to us in one of two ways, either as Yisro or as Amalek, and we must be prepared for both reactions. Vayavo Aaron v'chol zikni Yisrael le'echol lechem im chosein Moshe lifnei Elokim. So Aaron and all the elders of Israel, they came to dine with Moshe's father-in-law before God. Rashi comments that Moshe served everyone the food at this repast. One would have expected Yisro to be the one to serve the guests, since it was Yisro who offered the sacrifice, the korban. However, Yisro recognized that he was not in fact the true host. Since God owns everything, God in reality is the host. Moshe was therefore the most appropriate person to serve the food, since Moshe was God's shliach, his plenipotentiary. In an analogous way, when God came to visit Avraham, Avraham jumped up from his seat to receive the divine presence. God in effect said, "You are making a mistake, Avraham. You consider yourself the host and I'm the guest? The opposite is true. I, God, am the host and you are the guest. I am receiving you not in your tent, but in my tent. This is my tent. Nothing on earth is truly yours, so please remain seated." It says, "Vayeshev Moshe lishbot es ha'am." Now, literally, it gets translated as Moshe sat to judge the people. The term shofet does not denote judicial action or judicial activity exclusively. Shofet refers not only to a judge, but it means to have concern, to advise, to help, to provide fellowship. This connotation became obvious when we read within the Psalms of Kabbalah Shabbos, "The heavens will be glad and the earth will rejoice. The sea and its fullness will roar. The field and everything in it will exult. Then all the trees of the forest will sing with joy before Hashem." Why? For he will have arrived. He will have arrived, kiva lishpot es ha'aretz, to judge the earth. Doesn't mean to judge. Lishpot es ha'aretz. What does it mean? Yishpot tevel b'tzedek, v'amim be'emunaso. If the Almighty is coming to judge the world, then joy, song, and ecstatic gladness and dancing would seem out of place. The same problem arises when we read other verses in the Tehillim. He gives an example of Kapitel Tzadi Zayin, Pasuk Ches, and Tzadi Ches, Pasuk Psukim Zayin through Tes, 98, 7 through 9. The explanation of this anomaly is to be found in the multiple semantics of the word shin pei tes. Shin pei tes, shafat, here should not be understood in the sense of judging. Ki valish potaritz means God is coming from transcendent distances, from the mysterious beyond, to be closer to the world, to establish contact with the world, to show concern for and interest in the world. He involves himself in the destiny of man in general and in the destiny of his elected community in particular. Nearness of the Creator to his creation, closeness of man to God, inspires not fear, but joy and rapture. What is more exalting? What is more exalted? What is more sublime than to feel the touch of infinity on one shoulder? In a similar vein, the Greek and Latin translation of Sefer Shoftim is the Book of Judges. But if we analyze a sentence from that book, we will see the absurdity of the translation of Shofet as judge. It says that Devorah was Shofetus. She judged Israel. It doesn't mean judged Israel. It means she cared for Israel. She mentored Israel at that time. And the children of Israel came up to her for judgment. If the narrow definition of Shofet as judge is accurate, the whole story would make no sense. Nothing in the narrative indicates that she judged people. Instead, what is recorded is Devorah's devotion to the people and her political authority. She declared war on Sisera. She chose the commander-in-chief. She personally accompanied Barak to the field of battle and pursued Sisera. She sang the great song, the Shiras Devorah, of joy and praise. She was more than a judge and magistrate. She was a leader. She was a teacher. She was a friend of the people. Devorah describes herself as a mother in Israel, Ad Shekamti Em B'Yisrael. The children of Israel did not come to her for judgment, but for leadership, for guidance, for counsel, for advice. And the same is true of the entire book of Shoftim. It is not the book of judges, but the book of leaders, of the fathers. Shofet means more than mere judging. It embraces the whole gamut of human relations. In preparation for Har Sinai, Hashem tells Moshe, "Kos somar lebeis Yaakov v'saged livnei Yisrael." You should say tomar to Beis Yaakov, the Jewish women, v'saged, from the word kasha kigidin, hagada, to the Jewish children of Israel, the men. We have two mesoros, two traditions, two communities, two shalshelis ha-kabbalah, the mesorah community of the fathers and the mesorah community of the mothers. So shall you say to the house of Yaakov, Kos omar lebeis Yaakov, v'sagei livnei Yisrael, and tell the sons of Israel. Hear, my son, this is a quote from Proverbs, Mishlei, Perek Aleph, Pasuk Ches. Shma b'ni Musar avicha v'al titosh toras imecha. What is the distinction between Musar avicha and toras imecha? One learns much from father, how to read a text, the Tanakh, the Gemara, how to comprehend, how to analyze, how to conceptualize, how to classify, how to infer, how to apply. One also learns from father what to do and what not to do, what is morally correct and what is morally wrong. Father teaches the son the Musar, the discipline of thought, as well as the discipline of action. Father's tradition is an intellectual moral one. That is why it is identified with Musar, which is a biblical term for discipline, the discipline of your father. So what is Torah Simecha? What Torah does the mother pass on? Permit me to draw upon my own experiences. I used to watch my mother arranging the house in honor of the holiday or of Shabbos. I used to see her daven. I used to watch her recite the Sidra every Friday night, and I still remember the nostalgic tune. I learned from her very much. Most of all, I learned that Judaism, Yadus, expresses itself not only in the formal compliance of the halacha, but also in a living experience. She taught me that there is a flavor, a scent, and warmth to the mitzvos. I learned from her the most important thing in life, to feel the presence of the Shechina, of the Almighty, and the gentle pressure of his hand resting upon my frail shoulders. Without her teachings, which quite often were transmitted to me in silence, I would have grown up a soulless being, dry and insensitive. The laws of Shabbos, for instance, they were passed on to me by my father. They are part of Musar Avicha. But Shabbos as a living entity, as a queen, was revealed to me by my mother. It is a part of Torah Simecha. The fathers knew much about Shabbos. The mothers lived Shabbos, experienced her presence, perceived her beauty and splendor. The fathers taught generations how to observe Shabbos. The mothers taught generations how to greet the Shabbos and how to enjoy her 24-hour presence. It says, Ki li kol ha'aretz, right? Vatem tihiyu li mamlechas kohanim. You, the Jews, will be to me, Rashi says, a kingdom of educators, of role models. V'goy kadosh, a unique nation. Okay? He says all of that. But he said before that, I'm going to apologize. The pasuk before, it says, V'hiyisem li segula mikol ha'amim. You should be to me unique, a treasure from all the nations. But ki li kol ha'aretz, the whole earth is mine. Mine is the entire earth. The Ramban indicates that the Avos and the Shvatim, they observed mitzvos as long as they were in Eretz Yisrael, wherein their sanctity as Israel was complete. The opinion of the Ramban is based on the concept that the covenant of God with Avraham, and in turn with Yitzhak and Yaakov, in respect to the sanctity of Israel, it is bound up with the sanctity of the land. This is Perek Yud Zayin of Breishis, Pasuk Ches, that's by the Bris Milah. And I will give you and your seed after you the land of your sojournings, Eretz Megurecha, the entire land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be to them for a God. The personal sanctity flowing from the covenant cannot be separated from Eretz Megurecha, the land of your sojournings, from the sanctity of the land of Israel. However, when God revealed himself in Egypt and at Sinai, and he made a new covenant with us, this new sanctity which replaced the original covenant, it was not connected with the land of Israel. And now if you obey me and you keep my covenant, v'hiyisem li segula mikoamim, you will be a treasure to me from all of the nations, ki li kol ha'aretz, for the entire earth is mine. Wherever a Jew is to be found, the sanctity is with him, and he remains a son of a holy people. It is beyond time and place. Rashi, it seems, goes a step further. In Rashi's opinion, the bris at Sinai, the covenant at Mount Sinai, did not replace the bris of the Avos, the covenant of the forefathers that took place by the Mila. It was added to the bris Avos. Today, the Jew is doubly sanctified. with the sanctity of the covenant made with the Avos, and with the sanctity of the covenant at Sinai. According to Rashi, then, the Jew who lives in the Eretz Yisrael is endowed with two sanctities, Bris Avos and Bris Sinai, while one living abroad, living in Chutz La'aretz, must be satisfied with the Bris of Sinai alone, the Bris of the Torah, since he lacks the sanctity of Avram, which is indivisibly bound up with the land. What's Kili Kol Ha'aretz? God, in essence, said, I am giving the law to you, and you will become my firstborn. You will become my precious child. But don't think for a moment that I'm going to abandon the world or abolish humanity. Yes, you will be elected. I will be on the intimate terms with you. You will be my messengers, my kohanim, my mentors, my representatives. But the rest of the world, they will not be abandoned. Ki li kol ha'aretz. Okay. So the Jews are told v'kidashtem. Moshe tells the Jews they have to prepare themselves. Not v'kidashtem, sanctify themselves, but prepare themselves. Unkelus translates this word as prepare, okay? Holiness means preparation. Sanctity is not a transcendental phenomena which arrives against man's will. Man does not bear the yoke of holiness if he does not want it. Man must choose it. He must wait for it, yearn for it. Only then does Kedusha descend slowly and cleave to us. In the three-day prelude to Matan Torah, to receiving the Torah, Moshe warned the nation, right? Prepare yourselves for 3 days. Similarly, Aaron had to submit to a seven-day preparation period before the dedication of the what we call the Chanukah HaMizbeach, the dedication of the Mishkan, of the tabernacle. And every Kohen Gadol each year subsequently went through a similar sequester prior to Yom Kippur. What is the analogy between Aaron's preparation prior to the sanctification of the tabernacle, its dedication, and Yom Kippur? Both involved an encounter with holiness. Holiness does not arrive suddenly. It comes only by the invitation inherent in the act of preparation. Ein kedusha b'li hachana. It says, Bimshocha yovel hema yalu vahar. After the experience at Mount Sinai, when the shofar blows, then the Jews can return to climb that mountain, to rest on that mountain, to have their animals graze on the mountain. This verse suggests an interesting halachic historical paradox. Jews today are prohibited from walking on Mount Moriah, on the Temple Mount. No power in the world can neutralize the holiness of this spot. Yet, however, there is no prohibition to climb Mount Sinai, upon which the Torah was given. Mount Sinai maintains no residual kedusha, holiness. Why is there a difference in halachic status between the two mountains? Israel did not participate in the giving of the Torah. They slept on the night of Shavuos, and Moshe had to coax the people out of their tents to receive the Torah. The children of Israel themselves did nothing to contribute to this seminal event. As a result, despite being the site of the greatest divine revolution in human history, none of Mount Sinai's holiness endures. As soon as the revelation was over, as soon as Hashem's presence departed, the holiness of the mountain vanished as well. The circumstances surrounding the events at Har HaMoriah, the Makom HaMikdash, that's very different. Our forefather Avraham prepared an altar on that mountain. He placed his son Yitzchak upon it as a sacrifice. Avraham thus became a partner in the endowment of Kedusha, permeating the Temple Mount. The role of man in the endowment of holiness is a central theme in Halacha. For example, if a scribe writes a Torah scroll, Sefer Torah, and does not explicitly note the sanctity of the Yud Kei Vav Kei, of the ineffable name, while writing the name, neither the name nor the scroll has any sanctity. The loftiness of the text itself makes no difference. If the scribe does not write the name with intent, that he is writing for the purpose of vesting holiness in the scroll, then the ultimate expression of faith itself, the Shema, becomes profane. A Torah scroll is invested with holiness by man. A sacrifice is consecrated by virtue of man's designation. It is Knesset Yisrael, the Jewish people who sanctify the holidays through the establishment of the new moon, of the new month. Whether sanctity is vested in physical matter or in time, we find few instances where man is not the active participant in the establishment of Kedusha. The beginning of the Decalogue says, V'yadaber Elohim es kol hadvarim ha'elu le'mor. V'yadaber Elohim es kol hadvarim ha'elu le'mor. What are kol hadvarim? So Rashi says something fascinating there. What does Rashi teach us? The word kol, you know, can mean in Hebrew, could mean one of two things. If I say to you, please bring all the pieces of the puzzle. So let's say there's a puzzle with 500 pieces. I'm asking you to bring each one of the 500 pieces. But kol can also mean an organic entity. My whole body. What's my body? My body is not two kidneys and two eyes and two ears and a nose. It's an organic entity, a complete unit. When it says, V'yedaber Elohim es kol hadvarim ha'ila le'mor, Rashi says the following. It's not Rashi, it's the Mechilta that Rashi is quoting. What Hashem did was, he said in one cacophony, the whole Decalogue. All 10 statements were said in one shot. Now, obviously, no one can comprehend them. You can't comprehend when 10 voices are communicating 10 different things. All you hear is noise, a cacophony. So what was the purpose of Hashem to do that? That's the very beginning of the experience at Har Sinai. It's not Anochi Hashem Elokecha. It's not Lo Yiyeh Lecha. Before he started with the first of the Decalogue and the second of the Decalogue, the very first thing that Hashem did was he communicated all 10 in one shot, a cacophony. Why? And the answer is that what Hashem was teaching us is that as Jews, we don't have to become Jewish. The Jews at Har Sinai could have remained B'nai Noach. They could have remained ethical monotheists. That's the first religion in the Torah. But if they're going to adopt the system of perfected ethical monotheism, they're going to adopt a system like that, you can't pick and choose. You can't be a person that wears Rabbeinu Tam Tefillin and finishes Rabbeinu Tam Zman Shabbos and then doesn't treat your workers appropriately or pays workers off the books or cheats on taxes. No such thing. Don't become a Jew. That's a corruption and a perversion. And likewise, if you're a person that's a very ethical, generous, moral person, but there's no Shabbos, there's no God, that's not Judaism. Because in the end, without a God, you end up defining, everyone has their own definition of what's Lo Tirzach. That very sweet, wonderful, moral person will end up becoming a murderer because in the name of compassion and euthanasia, they'll pull the plug on a living being. That is why you can't pick and choose. There's either the whole system as an organic entity, and that's why half is Bein Adam L'Makom, half is Bein Adam L'Chaveiro. It's Luchat, it's an Evan, it's not Avanim. It becomes one stone, it becomes one tablet, it becomes one entity. It's an organic whole, Kol Hadvarim. If you accept the system in its entirety, in its totality, then we can move forward and explain the details of the specifics. But if not, if you're going to pick and choose, then it's a corrupt system. The next point we're going to make on the Decalogue, and I'm going to apologize because we're so over time, but the Rav, to do justice, you've got to get the New Worth Masoros HaRav Chumash. I'm only picking small pieces of the rich, incredibly, incredibly rich material there is in Parshas Yisro, in every Parsha, but particularly in Yisro. What does it mean when it says, Lo yeh lecha Elohim acherim al panai? You shouldn't have gods of others. What's al panai? The Rambam lived in an age where there were no idols. He had never been in a Christian society, and the Muslims were not idolaters. The Rambam's understanding of Lo yeh lecha Elohim acherim al panai is thus a philosophical one, a philosophy that explains the finite universe in terms of itself, without recourse to infinity, to the Ein Sof. That is Avodah Zarah. If someone singles out a certain principle, besides other than God, as the source of being, or as the final objective of being, that too is idolatry. And we all know many people who their whole source of reality, it might be science, it might be a certain leader, it might be a certain person, it might be a certain value. That's avodah zarah. It's anything other than God. Scientifically, the universe is a closed unit. We do not understand the universe from a perspective outside of it. We don't know how the universe came into being or why. On a scientific level, one cannot ask what sustains the universe. From the perspective of a closed system, the universe is self-sustaining. However, if a Jew should accept the internal explanation as the ultimate one, he would be an oved avodah zarah. He would have substituted something besides God as absolute and self-sufficient. Judaism has spoken many times about tivo shel olam, or nature, the cosmic drama as determined by the law of causality. We insist that everything in the universe reflects something or someone who is both within the universe and outside the universe, and this is God. But there are three other interpretations of Al Panai. Unkelus translates it instead of me, hence, to supplement me or to supersede me. Rashi understands it as throughout the duration of my existence. Al Panai, as long as I exist. The Ramban interprets the phrase as in my presence. What's Al Panai? Literally, in front of my face, in my presence. According to the Ramban, Avodah Zarah is abominable, and it's culpable precisely because it is in the presence of a Kodesh Baruch Hu. The sin of Avodah Zarah is very often identified with adultery, because the relationship of God and Bnei Yisrael is like that of a husband and a wife. Thus the phrase, Asher Atem Zonim Achareihem, because it constitutes zinus, adultery. Similarly, upon every lofty hill and upon every leafy tree, you wander like a harlot. That's Yirmiyahu Perek Beis Pasuk Chaf. There are two aspects to adultery. There is a desecration of a commitment, the breach of a contract, the betrayal of a partner, as well as the humiliation of the partner who is betrayed. With regard to the first aspect, it doesn't matter whether the partner knows or doesn't know of your adultery. With regard to the second, it is only humiliating if it occurs in the presence of the cheated partner. So according to the Ramban, God asks us to treat him as he would a human being and avoid causing him humiliation, as it were. There is a further implication in the Ramban's interpretation of Al Panai, in my presence, one that is very important for our entire outlook on life. The Ramban presupposes the omnipresence of God. This notion of God's omnipresence, it has two dimensions. There's the metaphysical principle, the theological postulate, that milo chol ha'aretz kvodo, that the whole world is filled with God's glory. There is also a moral principle. A Jew does not live in two worlds. We do not recognize a dichotomy between the ecclesiastical and the secular areas of life. Every aspect of our lives is in God's presence. Rashi, by contrast, stresses the eternity of God's existence, noting that otherwise one might think that this prohibition would be limited to the Dor HaMidbar. What does it mean? Remember what Rashi said? Rashi understands this throughout the duration of my existence, meaning not just to the generation that received the Torah, but to each and every generation. Why does Rashi raise this as a possible concern in regard to the Isser Avodah Zarah? After all, Rashi does not say this about Lo Tirtzach or Lo Tignov, thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not kidnap. Why might one have assumed that when it comes to idolatry, that the prohibition would expire after the first generation? That's the question. So the Rav answered, those people whom Moshe led out of Egypt, they had been reared in an idolatrous society. They were in danger of relapsing. They needed the injunction. We might have thought that the next generation would not be subject to the temptation of Avodah Zarah. It would not require a formal prohibition. This is why the Torah, according to Rashi's approach, it emphasized Al Panai, that all subsequent generations need to be bound by the same restriction against Avodah Zarah. The Torah apparently felt that even the most civilized man will be tempted by various sophisticated forms of idolatry. Chazal described Yeravam ben Nevat as a great scholar, an intellectual giant, to show us that intellectual heights and idolatry are not incompatible. How can we understand this gravitational pull, this inescapable attraction of Avodah Zarah? Even a leader, however great, needs a higher authority to endorse his actions.
All men experience feelings of loneliness and helplessness, and they need to have faith in someone superior to them. A person who does not believe in God will construct his own idol. And there are many types of idols. The corporate state, a utopian social order, science, and so on. It is noteworthy that the injunction is against idolatry, not against atheism. Why? Why is there no prohibition against atheism? Because there really is no atheism. One either relies on a Kodesh Baruch Hu or on some form of idolatry. No one remains a skeptic for long. Everyone needs some belief, some ideal, some value system to serve as an anchor in life. This, again, is why the prohibition was not limited to that generation alone. And this same idea is reflected in the opinion of Unkelus. Atheism as such, it will never replace, supplant, or supersede religion. Rather, a godless religion, that's what will supplant religion, a religion that would normally be theocentric. Modern man has not rejected religion. Modern man has rejected God as the focal point of his religion. There's much more, but unfortunately we're over time.